And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
So much hanging in the balance. Is there another shoe set to drop? Hurricane Ike takes a swing at the coast. An emerging global economic meltdown. Presidential campaigns shooting spitballs in the halls of history. And worst of all, the latest O.J. Simpson trial has locked up headline news. Priority one, the search for a way out. In America, we call that quest an election. And somehow, Sarah Palin has been chosen by the Republicans as the most qualified and ready person to lead us all through the storm. Who is Sarah Palin? Our quest to know is coming up on your Voice of the Earth, here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Wow, what times we live in. People in the Gulf Coast are sorting through the debris of Hurricane Ike that's driven Galveston back into the sea, as Houston struggles through the dark to find the switch to turn on the electricity. And while that storm wipes out our oil refineries, while the McCain campaign says that the answer to lowering oil prices is to drill, 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 the price of oil drops $60 a barrel to around $90 now. And then globalization smashes a fist on the American economy as an otherwise solvent company, AIG, with over $1 trillion in assets, is reduced to ashes and burns the economic foundations of nations around the world. And while all of this happens, O.J. Simpson is back in court with live coverage on headline news. Beware the Ides of September. It's clear to me that who runs this country has dramatic effects at every level on the lives of we here in the United States and people around the world. All my life I've believed in an enduring America, a land of the people, by the people, and for the people. But that has been turned on its head by a few people who believe in some form of the golden bough, the divine right of kings to rule. The decider will decide, because he knows better what's best for us than the people themselves. I'm beginning to think of this place in history from the perspective of trends. It's the best way for me to define what drives my decision-making. And in so many areas, the economy, America's legacy, the environment, energy independence, education, health care for real people, the prospects for peace, the trends in recent years have all taken a huge, giant step backwards. So when it comes to deciding who will move us forward, I have to look at who will advance the trend lines most effectively and in which direction. Today, we continue our look at Sarah Palin, who, if elected, will win the crown as chief decider, to see how she might affect the trends of change. Today, we focus on a wide spectrum of decisions which Sarah Palin has influenced as governor of the state of Alaska, to help us understand the impact she would have if elected in November. This show is in two parts. Listen and pass it on. Last week, I focused on Sarah Palin, the new vice presidential candidate running with John McCain, and it's just an ongoing saga that keeps developing. And quite honestly, it's very confusing. It's hard for me to sort out who she is based on the myriads of stories and things. And so that's what we need to know, though, because at this point in our history, these decisions that will affect the environment are very likely decisions that will affect literally many aspects of life on Earth, and as well our way of life. And certainly today, as the economic train wreck has apparently happened again, we have hard decisions for this country to make. And so who takes the control and leads this country to wherever we go is critically important. As it relates to the environment, I'm looking for people who have real experience with Sarah Palin. And so I want to invite to the show Peter Van Tine, who's with Bessonnier and Van Tine in Anchorage, Alaska. Peter, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
And Peter, give us a handle on what your perspective is here and why this can help us to understand Sarah Palin better.
Sure. I'm an environmental lawyer in Anchorage. Most of the last 20 years I've spent working here, loving living here, spend a lot of time in the outdoors, so that gives me a lot of concern for what's been going on and passion to work on the issues. But from a professional perspective, I'm an attorney that represents conservation groups, national conservation groups, Alaska-based conservation groups. I've worked on the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge campaign for 15 years or so, as one example, do a lot of marine fisheries conservation work and other oil and gas work as well. And I also represent Alaska Native tribes and villages on these similar issues, whether it's working with the Gwich'in people to help protect the Arctic Refuge or the native village of Point Hope, which is a small community, the oldest community in North America, far northwest Alaska. It's a whaling-based community for subsistence purposes, and they are very concerned about the massive expansion of oil and gas activities that the Bush administration, with the support of the state, is pushing offshore of their coast. That's my background, and it's something I felt privileged to do, but it's also given me some unfortunate experience with state of Alaska politicians.
You know, for those of us who live in other parts of the world instead of Alaska, we all have our images. My image of Alaska is it's a very, very large place. Most of the population lives along the coastal areas with vast open spaces. Give us a sense of the degree to which the resource extraction really affects, let's say, the people and then the place specifically.
Well, I mean, you can look at it economically, I think, is probably the biggest impact that it's had. When Alaska became a state in 1959, we were able to accept a fair amount of acreage from the federal government. We were a territory, and as part of our deal coming into the Union, the state of Alaska got about, I think it was 35 million acres or so, that it took title to, and that included, luckily enough, although I think there was some good intelligence that went into the decision, the area around Prudhoe Bay. And this is in the 1960s where that big elephant oil field that still provides so much oil to the Trans-Alaska Pipeline was found. And now there's an industrial area around Prudhoe Bay that's roughly about bigger than Rhode Island, actually. Mm. And it's a web of development that extends about 110 miles across the coastal plain. On the state lands there, and is heading into the National Petroleum Reserve Alaska, which is federal, a large block of federal land. And there's just a lot of money that comes out of that to the state of Alaska. We've got about $36 billion in the bank account. We've got about, 85% of our annual budget comes from those royalties on the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, so we do not have a state income tax. We do not have a statewide sales tax. Our property tax burden is focused on your county or your municipality, and in most cases is pretty reasonable, especially when you look at it in the big picture. So economically, the state residents have done quite well. Just last Friday, I believe it was, I have a family, a wife and two children, and just by virtue of the fact that we live here, we received just over $12,000 in money from the state of Alaska.
Now, is that an annual bonus?
Well, the money changes. It's called a permanent fund dividend, and it's part of our savings account is committed over to providing a dividend to the residents of Alaska. Anyone who's been here longer than a year and has an intent to stay here is eligible to receive the permanent fund dividend. This year, that was about $2,100. That might be the biggest one ever. Typically, it's between $1,000 and $1,500. And in addition, on top of that, Governor Palin she made the decision to provide another $1,200 payment to every resident who qualifies for the dividend. On top of that, as a sort of energy help, was the idea. There's no limits put on what you can do with the money. But what it meant is about $3,300 for every resident of the state that came into bank accounts last week. And, that's a pretty fortunate position for states to be in.
It's kind of a form of Social Security.
But, you know, and it's you know, to everybody, you know, as long as you live here, again, with the for over 1 year, the intent to permanently remain, you're eligible for it. So a lot of people get it. Family of four, that's a lot of money.
It is. It is. A lot of people, of course, it's very expensive to live in Alaska. Certain aspects are. So.
You know, I Sydney, I think that's true for the Bush communities. Uh-huh. I lived in D.C., though.
Yeah.
For, you know, actually in the early 1990s for a couple of years when I worked for the Department of Justice. And I found the cost of living there to be pretty high as well. So for Anchorage, yeah, the cost of living I don't think is significantly. It's not cheap to live here, but it's not super expensive. But
right.
If you're in the Bush communities, you're right. If you're off that road system and you're in a more remote area, a lot of the Alaska Native communities, you're talking very significant prices for your basic staples, whether it's milk and other things. There was a report in the paper today about $11 a gallon milk in one community, as well as gas prices. It's a little ironic given that we've got so many of those resources in state, but we have a difficult time getting it to some of those remote communities
right.
at a reasonable price.
Yeah, it's an unusual mix, Alaska is. It stands alone. One of the perspectives that I keep trying to sort out here is there's a side to Sarah Palin that comes across as someone who is very dedicated to sort of providing a stable economic backdrop for the people of her state. And you know what? I respect anybody who's fighting for that. I guess the question would be, what's the price that is being paid for that, particularly as it relates now? We'll kind of shift over to the topic here. And that is the price that will be paid in terms of the environmental degradation and other larger realms. We're talking now about obviously oil and gas exploration, mineral exploration, mining, offshore fishing, hunting and predator control issues. It gets to be a little bit confusing, so I'm turning to you now to help us understand this dynamic and try to figure out what is Sarah Palin's modus operandi and her vision.
Let's talk about that economic-environmental interface for a moment, because the one thing that Sarah Palin holds herself out to the nation as is someone that stood up to the oil industry. And let's examine that for just a second, because I agree, she did. She came in following Frank Murkowski, who by all accounts was the worst governor that Alaska ever had, by far. Former senator, ran a bank before being a senator and had some economic troubles with that bank in southeast Alaska and was a senator for a long time, and then he came home as the governor, and by all accounts was the worst governor that Alaska's ever had.
He has a rough reputation.
He didn't do anything to polish it up as governor, I can tell you that. And
yes.
He lost in his own primary to Sarah Palin. So mm-hmm. She came in with a pretty low bar to raise things up in the state. When she did stand up to the oil company, it was on some of the issues that Frank Murkowski had fallen down so flat on, including the Trans-Alaska Gas Line. And really, that was pushing something. I think she did we'll see, it's not done yet. She characterized it as a finalized project in her speech at the Republican convention, but it's far mm-hmm. from it, many years away mm-hmm. from even beginning construction. Mm-hmm. But she did stand up to them on some tax issues that changed the allocation, if you will, of the money that comes out of the oil fields and gave the state a lot more money out of it. And that's great, you know, so it's an economic allocation between the oil and gas industry and the state of Alaska. I don't know how that relates to things that everybody else can get excited about, but for people in Alaska who, you know, get permanent fund dividends and big treasury hits from the oil and gas companies, that's great. Now, that does not mean, though, that she's been any different than previous governors on environmental issues, and I can give you several examples of that.
Okay.
You know, let's start with the oil and gas industry on the North Slope. It's something that the Bush administration, as I mentioned earlier, has been pushing a very strong expansion, especially into the offshore environment and into parts of the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska, and the Western Arctic. Large parts of that NPRA, as we call it, are, you know, legitimately good for, as its name suggests, petroleum production. And at the same time, back as far as the 1970s, when that place was dealt with in some federal legislation, there was a recognition that, boy, we don't know a lot about the NPRA. Let's be careful and analyze all of that information before we go forward. In the 1980s, James Watt, under President Reagan, who was by many considered until Gail Norton probably the worst Interior Secretary for the environment, he even protected a couple of areas in the NPRA when they were doing some lease sales then, and long time had blown off some of those protections, and only after multiple court battles and fights were we able to protect some of those areas, at least we'll at least temporarily, let me put it that way. So we see that as background, and the Bush administration also expanding offshore. Recently, they went in the Beaufort Sea from 9 million acres offered in leases to about 33 million. In the Chukchi Sea, we went from 0 to 40 million. And in the Bering Sea, home of some of the nation's biggest fisheries, went from 0 acres to about, I think it was 5.6 million that they'd like to lease there. And so what does this have to do with Sarah Palin? Well, the state has a huge influence over whether or not the federal government should be expanding oil and gas leasing onshore or offshore. The local communities on the North Slope borough, for example, and a lot of the native tribes and villages that live in smaller communities across that North Slope have been vigorously opposed to the offshore. They're marine mammal hunters, and they're very concerned because this is the truth. As a nation, we have no technology available to clean up oil in that environment if it gets spilled into it. And it's especially true if it happens when it's ice-covered or broken ice environment. It's not going to be easy to clean up at all, and the success rates are minuscule. I've been out on the Beaufort Sea in their experiments to determine whether or not that any kind of proposed new technology might work, and it was just a farce almost, with these kind of mops that they would put in the water and squeegee through a roller, and then have it bring it over onto the barge and try and put their simulated oil into a tank, and it didn't work at all. It was just a real farce, as I mentioned.
Is the issue partly this? I mean, certainly there's no doubt that America definitely has to address its energy needs. Obviously, there's a lot of energy potential up in Alaska. Obviously, there's a lot of pressure that's going to be put on developing that. But the real question is this: as that moves forward, should we be take into consideration in the most appropriate ways possible scientific and regulatory safeguards to make sure that as that develops, because it's going to happen, it's not going to stop, the pressure is there, but that at this particular time we should really be conscious of our need, and we have the scientific capabilities to really develop strategies to make this right, or at least to do the best we can. Is it part of this the fact that it's being sort of reversed, that some of those regulations are being taken away at a time when they should be increasing?
Yeah, the executive has so much discretion to do things correctly or do things poorly, and on the federal and state levels, we've just done it extremely poorly. And you're absolutely right that we should be looking at those kind of technologies, but we're never to the point where you are required to put them in place, prove them up before you open up these vast areas. And once you give vast areas to the oil industry, we know what happens. You can see examples of it all across the United States and all across the world. Is you get pollution. That's just the way it is.
Okay, it will happen. Yes.
Yeah. It's a necessary thing. It industrializes the area. So look at the offshore area, and let's apply the example to how Governor Palin has executed her duties there. And we see that animals like whales and polar bears can be impacted by that offshore activity. And as we also know, the United States cares for its wildlife, and Congress has passed many laws to protect it, including what is really almost the Noah's Ark, if you want to put it in religious terms, for someone like Sarah Palin, of those laws, which is the Endangered Species Act. And you had the Bush administration proposing to list, after multiple lawsuits forcing its hand on the issue, the polar bear as a listed species. And Governor Palin was fighting that every step of the way. In January of this year, she put an opinion piece out in the New York Times where she said, look, my state wildlife experts have done a comprehensive review of polar bear science, and they do not believe that listing the polar bear is the best result, is the smartest thing to do, is justified under the science. And so we looked at that as conservationists in Alaska. I mean, the federal government under the Bush administration, of all people, I mean, this is a pretty high scientific standard that they would require a polar bear protection strategy to meet. And they did 9 studies on various aspects of the polar bear issue, on polar bears themselves and ice in the Arctic and the projections into the future, and concluded that the best science, all of them said, we really need to do more to protect this bear. Let's put it on the list. And so in the end, Secretary Kempthorne at the Interior Department did, after many delays, many of them illegal, but finally, he was forced, after a court order, to issue it by a certain date, May 15, 2008. And he did. On May 14th, he announced that the federal government, the Bush administration, was listing the polar bear. And, you know, holy cow, that's, you know, again, the Bush administration doing it. So you know they were up against the wall. And the Governor Palin still opposed it. In fact, since then, she's filed a lawsuit against the listing. But let me tell you what happened along this whole period of time is that that comprehensive review that the state of Alaska supposedly did, the scientists of the state of Alaska supposedly did, doesn't exist. What does exist, they reviewed, the experts in the state agency reviewed the federal science and those nine studies that were done by the Interior Department to support that ultimately supported the listing. And they said internally in the state of Alaska that that is the best available science, and in fact, those studies support listing. So you had, this is very disturbing, you had Governor Palin taking what internally her scientists said and 180 degrees rewriting it, portraying to the public that her scientists had said the exact opposite. And then she refused to give to the public here in the state of Alaska that information, because we tried numerous ways to get it. And in the end, we went to the federal government under the Freedom of Information Act and got the information about the state experts from them. You know, how ironic that is, but we were able to use the federal law because the state had stymied all of our efforts under state law to get it, including proposing about, I think, $500,000 in search fees for public records to find one review of a few scientists. I mean, just exactly the kind of chilling effect that the Bush administration has done on a national level, Governor Palin does here. And the openness and transparency that she claims to be a hallmark of her style of governing is not something that I've seen here as a lawyer. I mean, I deal in the minutiae, and the legal minutiae for Sarah Palin is as complicated and labyrinthian as it has been with previous governors. And so, you know, that's really unfortunate. And I think the theme on that one is she's really willing to quash science in favor of her policy goal, because listing of the polar bear, the impression is among the oil industry people and the real big drilling boosters is that you will have to be more sensitive on your oil and gas activities to polar bears if it's listed, and therefore, if they're listed, and therefore, you know, we don't want it to be listed. And so she fights it, you know, hand in hand with the, you know, American Petroleum Institute and all the rest of the people that don't like those kind of things.
You're making an interesting point there, that it's these patterns of behavior that I think people need to look at, because it's the disingenuousness of her style that concerns me, because we must rely on science. Science is based on finding truth and finding facts and making right decisions about things, and certainly life is based on making right decisions. And it's this pattern of what I can only refer to as deceitfulness or disingenuousness that really concerns me, and certainly you've made that case very well in terms of this issue of the polar bear. And then on top of that, what really bothers me is that she then takes that truth and spins it out during her acceptance speech to say that she stood up to the Bush administration on this issue. Now I don't know the best metaphor, but that's adding insult to injury. In terms of communicating to the public and trying to give us a sense of who she is.
You know, it's state a lie and then repeat it regardless of consequences. And, you know, look, but you know, I think you mentioned that she, and I agree that she can manipulate or quash science, but I think she also has a disdain for science. And this is the best example here is probably the climate change science.
Yes.
We've got international experts. We've got, you know, so much unbelievable scientific body of knowledge out there about the reality of climate change as well as the human causes of it and contribution to it. And, you know, no science is in this kind of area is ever going to be perfect, but the questions about human influence on climate change have really narrowed to the point where it's only the most extreme people that will say that the human impact is not there on climate change. George Bush doesn't say it anymore. Ted Stevens doesn't say it anymore. You know, that leaves Don Young out there among our national you know, congressional folks and a few other people in Congress who say that. And Sarah Palin.
Yeah, you're right.
And in this context, she's to the right of George Bush.
Yeah.
You know? That's quite a maverick.
Well, maybe she's been, off, and I don't mean to demean people off in Alaska. It's a beautiful place to be. To be honest with you, there are times that I wish I was off in Alaska because things are so confusing here, you know.
It's more disingenuous than that if you think about it. I mean, what's the political result for Alaska of denying a human element to global climate change? Mm-hmm. And this gives us an insight into her politics, in my view. On the one hand, she doesn't deny that global warming exists. She can't deny that. We're front lines.
She does admit that it exists. She's already said that.
Yeah, you bet. Mm. We're front lines. You can't do it. Our communities in the bush that are on the coast are falling into the ocean. Our permafrost is melting. Our infrastructure in some areas is crumbling, and we've got to put a lot of money, a lot of it federal, into shoring that up.
Yeah, they just announced that there is now an Arctic pathway open this year, which hasn't happened, and this is a wonderful statistic, that this is the first time that that passage has been open in 125,000 years. So, yes.
You end up with opportunities from climate change in the terms of the economics of having a northern route across the top.
Exactly right.
And you end up with the concern about the impacts here, and we need to put to deal with the impacts of it. So we need, money to deal with that. So she wants to make sure she can get in line with everybody else for that. But when you leave out the human causes of it, what does that allow you to avoid? Aha, it allows you to avoid any limitations on your development activities to take your climate impact into account.
That's true.
And so, therefore, unfettered oil and gas activity, that can both have an impact on the environment where it occurs, as well as nationally and globally in a climate change context. This came up in the one interview she has deigned to give, or they've let her give, since she's been nominated as vice president, Charles Gibson. And she had a back and forth about it, and it's quite a revealing back and forth.
I don't know how long Sarah Palin has been in your radar screen. How long has she been sort of involved in your world?
She first really came to the attention of the political powers that be here, as mayor of Wasilla. It doesn't really get a lot of attention, but she had enough, ability to talk the Republican talk that she had run for lieutenant governor at one point and lost, but at that point, Frank Murkowski appointed her to one of those sweetheart jobs in state government as this oil and gas commission, and so she became chair of that. It was about $125,000 a year position. It's kind of it's not that she had any experience in oil and gas stuff, it's just that's where young Republicans go to cut their teeth, if you will, and so while there, she exposed some corruption that was going on with the Republican Party, to her credit, and that's when she really got on people's radar screen. It had to do with one of the other people on the commission, who was also the Republican Party chair, passing some privileged memos to oil industry lawyers that had to do with drilling plants, and just completely inappropriate, way out of line, way out of line activities that he was doing, and she called him on it and ended up resigning, and that set up her race when she beat Frank Murkowski because of the corrupt. I mean, we are extremely corrupt here from an oil and gas industry perspective.
Sure.
If you look at what goes on in the state legislature, if you look at what goes on with all of our politics here, it's industry pervades everything.
Well, you're not alone in Alaska with oil and gas industries having a lot to say and a lot of power.
Yeah.
It's kind of a universal theme right now.
Unbelievable what happened at the Interior Department, too.
Yes.
Sex, drugs, and rock and roll.
Excusing
billions of dollars in royalties because of it.
Ready to lead. No second thoughts. Sounds like the decider on steroids. Stay tuned as we continue our look at the prospect of President Palin.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sidney Wildsmith.
Okay, we've got a job opening for Vice President of the United States, and we're holding interviews. It's one of the most challenging jobs in America. We need someone qualified to take on this leadership role. We've already interviewed 100 candidates from business, science, universities, and the military. It's a parade of extremely intelligent, well-informed, experienced people. Our next interviewee is Sarah Palin, past mayor of Wasilla, 19 months as governor of Alaska, and a hockey mom who spends her mornings watching Russia just in case they decide to, well, invade. Coming up, part two of our in-depth look at our candidate, Palin. Stay tuned. Our talk with Peter Van Tine on the Palin presidency continues. She's an unusual character, and I'm trying to figure out what is the genuine person. I mean, for example, we don't have to get into this in a controversial way, but I mean, she certainly claims to be a creationist, and that relates to something that you said, that she may have a disdain for science, because there is a bit of people are, you know, kicking sand on each other in that arena. To what degree do you think that that belief is truly affects her decision-making process versus that could be more of a political plum that she can, you know, put in her identity such that she associates herself with kind of the right wing?
I think she's firmly there,
okay.
And has been, you know, in these churches that she's been involved with in Wasilla, Alaska, where she was, raised and was mayor. I mean, they're pretty strong viewpoints on a lot of those things, and it does show a disdain for science at some levels. So, I don't know if disdain is the right word, but it's certainly not science based. Doesn't acknowledge the kind of fundamental science things that we see in our schools, for example. There are other examples too in the environmental field where you see that. And I can use one here. I'm looking out right now on Cook Inlet, Alaska. It's a great body of water that comes up from the Gulf of Alaska with the Kenai Peninsula on one side and the Aleutian and the Alaska Range on the other. And it's about a 350-mile-long body of salt water, marine water, that comes up, like I said, from the Gulf of Alaska and the North Pacific. And then when it hits Anchorage, it splits into two, and it goes down Turnagain Arm, which is about 50 miles long and has the second largest tides in the world. Really cool, 35-foot tides.
Wow.
And the other side is Kinnick Arm. And we're fortunate in Cook Inlet to have a geographically an isolated and a distinct population of whales called the Cook Inlet beluga whales. These are really cool, medium-sized whales. They're white, and some people see them at the zoos, and they're the whale that looks like it's smiling. They have a great bulbous head. A very beautiful white color. And in their, historically, at least, the scientists tell us the population of Cook Inlet beluga whales is around 1,500 animals. And so we see them here. They follow the salmon around and some of the other smaller fish species. And so they're a real cool part of living here, is being able to see that. And that population, however, started to drop in the 90s. And part of it was due to native take for subsistence. And thankfully, those folks that were involved in native take started to see that, and they stopped taking the whale for subsistence purposes when the numbers start to really drop a lot. And at the same time, conservationists and the native community were like, we need to look at all the possible causes of the decline and what is going to help this population get back up to a healthy level.
Mm-hmm.
And the federal government, the National Marine Fisheries Service, it's called, it's sort of a corollary to the Fish and Wildlife Service that deals with polar bears. Well, this NIMS agency deals with whales. And they kept saying, we think it's going to rebound because the take has stopped, so we're not going to worry about it. And there have been state, federal urges to put it on the various endangered species list because the numbers were dropping 750, 600, 500.
That's very, very close to a non-viable population.
That's exactly what the U.S. Marine Mammal Commission, which is a federal agency charged with studying and protecting marine mammals, that's what it says.
I mean, if you study science at all, that's a critically low number.
Well, we are now at 350.
Oh, my gosh.
That's what we think. It's a really, really tragic situation.
Hmm.
And yet, we're not on the endangered species list yet.
Wow.
And the state of Alaska, with Governor Palin there, has been urging that there be no listing for the beluga whale. And what is it that she's scared of with the beluga whale? Well, let me tell you what other activities occur in Cook Inlet. One, it is the oldest oil and gas producing province in Alaska. Since the 1960s, there's been oil and gas production here. We've got about 19 or maybe 21 offshore rigs here in Cook Inlet.
Wow.
And what's remarkable about these, they're in what's called the coastal category of offshore. It's a federal category, the stuff that the offshore rigs that are closer to the coast than the ones that are really far away.
Mm-hmm.
And they're supposed to meet certain rules under the federal laws, like Clean Water Act, where in the rest of the country, such rigs cannot have any pollution discharge at all.
Mm-hmm.
So they do what's called zero discharge.
Mm-hmm.
And they re-inject the waste back underground in some of the reservoirs that are hopefully safe for them to keep that waste. And in Cook Inlet, they have always, the federal government, with the state support at every step, because the state has to support this kind of thing under the federal rules, have allowed those facilities to pollute directly into Cook Inlet. And these are toxic heavy metal stuff that, you know, you might imagine is part of the production process for oil and gas. And under the Palin administration, these areas of pollution that are around these drill rigs are called mixing zones.
Mm-hmm.
And this is an area where you're allowed to pollute to a level that exceeds, say, a healthy water quality standard that the state puts in place. Those mixing zones have tripled in size, and so it's, you know, the Clean Water Act has this whole entire process that's intended to take what at the time when it was enacted in the early 70s to big massive pollution that went into waters of the United States and get it to zero at some point in the future.
Mm-hmm.
So you're constantly seeking to limit and to make less the pollution that goes into the water, and yet here we are in Alaska and we're allowing it to expand. I mean, it's unbelievable. And the beluga whale swims through all that. So what impact is that having on the beluga whale? Well, nobody's studying that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what's another thing that happens in Cook Inlet? Well, the second bridge to nowhere. She touts so famously now that she didn't support the bridge to nowhere, and that was a reference to one that was in southeast Alaska. I think her views on that have actually been exposed as not particularly true.
Well, bogus. I mean, at what point can a person basically claim both truths at the same time? And unfortunately, it's been the tradition of this particular administration to do that. You know, that's how it operates. But
Clear Skies Initiative.
Exactly, correct.
Initiative.
Yes, yes, exactly.
It's the same kind of thing. You just repeat, you say something and you repeat it regardless of the facts.
That's right.
And that's what happened. But what she doesn't talk about is her continued support, at least as we've seen so far, to the second bridge to nowhere, which is across the mouth of Kinnick Arm, which is one of those bodies right here off of Anchorage. And so this bridge to nowhere is something that was funded by Don Young, Mr. Pork Barrel, and he was chair of the House Transportation Committee, at 73 members on that committee, largest committee in the Congress, and also considered the largest pork barrel committee, just because the transportation bills that get moved through them obviously contain a ton of money for infrastructure, very much needed infrastructure across the United States.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, it offers real opportunity for largesse, because a guy like Don Young can get a lot of political support for things like Don Young's Way, this huge bridge here.
Is that what they're calling? Is that the same bridge?
Oh, that's his name for it. I mean, Don Young's Way.
Really? Interesting.
You know, it's like a monument to yourself.
I heard it as Kinnick Arm or Kinnick Arm, isn't it?
Kinnick Arm is the body of water that it's... Young's Way is the name of the bridge.
Well, you know, I looked at it. I think I encourage everybody to go to Google Earth or some other form and just look that up, because what's very interesting about that is the story as you see it visually, and that's this Kinnick Arm that heads up past Anchorage. And what's the distance between Anchorage and Wasilla by road?
40 miles.
40 miles. Okay, so it's probably about a 20-some mile long distance between Anchorage and the end of Kinnick Arm. And so what they're proposing is that, and then, by the way, when you go up and around, then you get that's how you get to Wasilla.
That's correct.
Okay.
The bridge wouldn't make that trip any shorter, by the way.
No, it goes over to a land that probably would end up being developed, because there's almost nothing there.
There's been some reports about who owns that land, and you wouldn't be surprised to see names of people that are good friends or relatives of Don Young.
Yes. Well, it is to me. It's just another huge pork barrel project, and I encourage people to look at that because you'll see. Because once you cross the bridge, you go over Don Young's Bridge, then basically it leads to nowhere unless, of course, you make a right hand turn, in which the closest town is Wasilla.
Wasilla. Huh. I'll tell you what's So you have that sort of earmark, just bad public policy aspect of that bridge to nowhere, and you've got the potential environmental impact. And to relate it to the beluga listing situation, one of the things that the experts say is that the bridge designs so far, which are very, very expensive in their own right, and far exceeding what was originally projected it would cost, those bridge designs could have an impact on Kinnikum in a way that could also impact belugas. So having the beluga listed under the Endangered Species Act would require the proponents of the bridge, who are using a ton of federal money, right? I mean, so far, I don't know how much, about $40 million, actually, of federal money has been spent on this already.
I think it's projected at $250 million for the project. Is that about right? And that's at the current state?
That might be federal coming.
Uh-huh, gotcha.
That's only a small portion
of
the total cost. And, but to have endangered species that are potentially impacted by that requires what's called consultation. So the National Marine Fisheries Service would have to look at this bridge design and say, okay, is that going to impact this Cook Inlet beluga whale? And how so? And maybe you should change it to be more sensitive to the whale in X, Y, or Z ways. And that could potentially, those are no guarantees, right? I mean, it could just, the National Marine Fisheries Service could just say, go ahead with the bridge. But just even the potential that it could raise some of the costs, I think leads someone like Governor Palin to oppose the listing because they just don't want that extra layer of regulation. Despite the fact that I'm very sensitive to wildlife, and the environment, I'm an Alaskan after all. That kind of talk, it doesn't, when it comes down to it, matter in those decisions that she makes about what positions the state should take about things like endangered species.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's so many issues, and this is the challenge. I mean, also this whole issue of aerial hunting of wolves and bear. It's something that's been part of Alaska history, although I think for a while it was banned in Alaska, wasn't it?
Well, it's predator control is what we call it here.
Right.
What we call it here.
Yeah, right, correct.
Sarah Palin has, her version of predator control is one that is not science-based.
Mm-hmm.
And we can say that because the National Academy of Sciences, which is probably the most esteemed scientific body in the United States, they choose expert panels to look into specific issues that tap people from academia and other sources internationally and nationally, the best people to look at various issues that come up and they need to look at. And so they issued a report in 1997, I believe, and it said, look, a science-based predator control program in Alaska would look like this. And they gave a bunch of standards and benchmarks that a science-based program would mean. And Governor Palin came in on a platform that supported predator control. No, it wasn't hiding anything there. She was a strong proponent of predator control. She appointed members to the State Board of Game, which crafts and helps implement these things, that were strong proponents of predator control, and nobody on there that supports a non-consumptive, use, if you will, or perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And so these folks on the Board of Game, with Sarah's strong support, have expanded predator control Alaska to include things like bounties. I mean, holy cow.
Right.
That's a tool that, well over a half century was given up for these kind of things. And thankfully, a court struck it down as violating the law. But nevertheless, it was certainly something that was supported. The other thing is private hunters going up in airplanes and shooting wolves from airplanes. We allow that to happen in Alaska now, and that's been banned by Citizen Initiative a couple times, but Governor Palin came in and expanded it. So we have well over 100 pairs. So you and I own a plane, and you like to shoot wolves from planes. So we go up in my plane after the state sanctions us and tells us where we can go, and we go in the spring typically because that's when you can track the wolves easiest on the snow, and you have a lot of daylight, and track them down by plane and shoot them from the air.
How many could I shoot?
Well, it depends on the goal for the particular area.
I see.
But the goal in some areas is eradication of up to 80% of the predators. And the idea is if you get rid of the wolves and the bears, you can allow the moose and caribou. This is the idea, but again, it's not perfectly based on science. You would then allow the moose and the caribou numbers to increase and provide greater opportunity for sport and trophy hunters to go and get those.
Along with this approach, does she include science? In other words, are wildlife management experts allowed to do the field work to determine the populations? Is that part of the mix?
Well, state experts do go out and kill wolves and bears, mm-hmm. including wolf pups this mm-hmm. year.
Yes, right. Out, yes.
And pulling them out of dens, and, you know, that which is also a violation of state mm-hmm. law. So, you know, I don't think that anyone can argue that this is a science-based program. We've got mm-hmm. another, I'm not sure if it's the United States Society of Mammalogists or an international society that has spoken up and had some concerns about the sustainable nature of wildlife management practices like this in Alaska. And 172 scientists, wrote a letter that went to the state of Alaska in this predator control program that Governor Palin put together that criticized that program as well as not science-based. So it's just a challenging situation, this governor. That's something that in the lower 48, when we used to see the great herds of buffalo or, you know, well, I think Yellowstone's probably the best example mm-hmm, mm-hmm. of what a healthy ecosystem can be like with wolves in the ecological chain and how exciting that is to see. And,
certainly
and we're
is.
Fortunate where I live in Alaska. I live literally on a 500,000-acre state park attached to a 5-million-acre national forest. That is my backyard. And, you know, we have grizzly bears, we have wolves, we have all sorts of moose that come through all the time, and, you know, we feel privileged to live here.
And, you know, the truth is, you're a very lucky person, because the vision that I keep seeing of America as we go forward here is that those values are just being sort of forgotten. It's as if a vision of a balanced ecosystem where animals actually live in their natural balanced forms is something that we're willing to just write off now as sort of history, or to me it represents the deepest of American values. This country was founded on our lands being a sacred place. And
Alaska's had and still has a great contribution to that American legacy.
It does.
Unique in the world,
yeah,
really.
Yeah.
And, you know, we had this wonderful law called the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act,
mm-hmm.
and it put aside a lot of land into conservation areas for the benefit, like it says in the title, for the national interest. So
mm-hmm.
whether you live in California or on the East Coast or in southern United States or in Alaska, you've got these lands that are federal lands that are here for you. And they not only support a large economy in Alaska of tourism, of course everyone wants to come see Denali National Park or Glacier Bay. More people are getting to wrangle St. Elias National Park and, you know, down in Katmai to see the bears or Kenai Fjords. I mean, we've got some absolutely unbelievable federal lands. The Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, you know, is another great example. And, you know, what's so interesting living here is that certainly the state in which the federal lands exist should have an important role in how they're managed, but it shouldn't have final say in how they're managed. And that's for good reason, because the state doesn't own the land. American citizens own the land. And what I find pretty interesting is seeing arguments from Ted Stevens and Governor Palin and others that we should do what the state of Alaska wants to do, that somehow there's a broken promise here that we need to open up these lands in order to help the state of Alaska. I think about that, and I think about $36 billion in the bank, and I think about the money that, you know, we got last week, and I'm willing to sacrifice some of that in order to have a wilderness that's untrammeled by man, a wild area that has, you know, the environment much as it was a long time ago.
She seems, you know, I'm trying to figure Sarah Palin out. I guess from my perspective, she is an avid hunter. There's nothing wrong with that. But it is as if that value or that desire seems to, that it's all about hunting, too much about hunting, too much. It's a balance. It's a balancing act here, and it's a judgment calls. And that as well, you're blessed with extraordinary resources there, but it always seems to me that the emphasis is on the economic value, even that this concept of wolf hunting from the air and bears. A lot of people are suggesting that really is catering to certain wealthy people who can afford to rent a plane and go hunting because it's fun.
It certainly isn't, as some characterize it, to be demonstrating a sensitivity to native populations who care a lot about subsistence. Mm-hmm. You know, as someone who's lived in Alaska for a long time, you know, mm-hmm. the subsistence is a very, very important, critical part of many Alaskans' lives, mm-hmm. whatever your walk of life.
Yes.
And especially for those who live in bush mm-hmm. communities, and especially for our Alaska Native communities that mm-hmm. for thousands upon thousands of years have relied upon the natural resources to allow them to subsist. In fact, you cannot separate the Gwich'in people from the porcupine caribou herd. You just can't do it. I mean, mm-hmm. it's their reason for living where they do and living how they do, and it's such an integral part of their lives that it's not, if you look at subsistence as a food thing, you'd be too narrow in your view. It's really a foundation for their culture, that opportunity for subsistence. And that's also true of whaling, and this is an international recognition that, hey, commercial whaling isn't something that we're going to allow. You know, we'll have this little farce about research whaling by the Japanese in some contexts, but for the most part, you know, subsistence whaling has that international support because they recognize that people are part of the ecosystem too, and it's okay, you know, in that context to allow people who've been doing this for millennia, so long as the whale population is healthy and sustainable, to allow some take of that population to support those coastal communities that have been doing that for thousands upon thousands of years, so long as the whale population is healthy. But the predator control program here is not at all about that kind of hunting. It is not at all about protecting the folks that need a lot of protection from impacts on their subsistence resources. It's about sport and trophy hunting, and like you say, the you know sport hunting, that's fine. It's a you know in context that it's fine, but it should be science based. Mm-hmm. And when you're going to do it in an unsustainable format to the exclusion of some of the apex predators in the ecosystem, you're messing with things that our kids are going to have to deal with and our grandkids are going to have to deal with. And we're not going to be leaving them an Earth that is near as diverse and strong as the Earth we were left with by the people who came before us. And that's a shame.
When you talk about the Native Alaskan peoples and their relationship between themselves and their ways and the world around them, the totally integrated world around them, it's a way of life. And the interesting thing, as we talk here, and thanks so much, this has been an amazing conversation, is that they aren't necessarily science-based, except they, in fact, are. They know the science. They know what happens if an imbalance begins to occur. They don't put it in scientific terms. It's almost just knowledge and wisdom. I also am a scientist, and based on my research of animal ecosystems and whatever else, I understand the importance of this balance. And therefore, when I see these radical answers to complex questions, what concerns me is not that necessary. I mean, there's many things that concern me, but it isn't just that I care about whales or wolves or bison, but also just the whole integrated system, and that we're endangering much, much larger aspects of life. That's why these things do have ramifications out into the larger realms, and as it relates to her becoming a vice president and very conceivably a president, I hate to think how those values might translate into America. Generally speaking, many, many traditional towns and villages are being highly impacted by mountaintop removal and gas fields in the Four Corners area where their lives are completely changed. So I'm just concerned that there's a value system here that is destructive to American values. And I think that needs to be addressed. Bottom line, Peter, what is her motivation? What's your take on this? I mean, obviously that guy like Murkowski was probably just in the pocket of the oil companies. I don't know that it's that simple, or is it?
With Governor Palin,
correct.
Certainly not in the, you know, pocket of industry, of the oil industry, I wouldn't say that, but the alignment of a very strong development agenda for the typical Alaska politician, and I put Sarah Palin in that category, is so great that, you know, that's where you're going to see her decisions going. She said it here in Alaska. She was here last weekend. And, you know, she's speaking to a crowd that was at a convention center downtown on Saturday morning, and her message was, make no mistake, when McCain, Palin are in the White House, we will drill now.
Yeah.
I'll tell you, Sydney, one of the great things about last Saturday, though, was that she had fewer people at her rally in Anchorage. This is you know, her core base then showed up at a protest rally just across town by the library because of concerns of what she might do to libraries across the country, that showed up to protest. 1,500 people, which for Alaska is, some are calling it, if not the largest, one of the largest political protests that has ever been put on in Alaska.
That's cute.
That's right. And it you can find this if you were just to Google Palin in protest or Palin protest and Alaska, you would find this. It's just been a great, it was a great protest rally of about 1,500 people, and just to say that, hey, not all Alaskans are like this. You know, this is the power structure that's there right now. It's the typical power structure that aligns with the strong development interests, but it's not all Alaskans. And there were a ton of scientists there. There were, you'll enjoy this, a ton of people there with masks on because they were state and federal employees who do not feel that our society here is open enough for them to express their views openly. It could have job consequences for them. There was an AM radio shock jock that put out the information on the organizers of the rally on the radio, and those organizers got hate mail and hate email, and just real inciting, just really calling them socialist baby-killing maggots. You know, this is the kind of talk that goes on here in the shock jock world. So I think a lot of people that got some media attention, a lot of people ended up showing up and saying, no, we are allowed civil discourse by our Constitution and to express our opinions. And by golly, we're going to do that. And you should see some of the signs that were there. Polar bear moms say no to Palin. So that was very heartening to me to see that more people showed up on Palin's last day here in Alaska before she heads out in earnest on that campaign trail to protest her policies than to support them.
Bottom line for me is that it just feels as if McCain-Palin presidency would be business as usual. And business as usual at this point is a trend line. And the trend line is removing protections that Americans have put into place and wanted and enacted for 40 and 50 years of the environmental movement. And they're being dismantled and rewritten and removed, you know, by executive or other order. And so that, I guess the bottom line for me is that trend line would continue, and there would be no effort to change that.
I think in some of these environmental issues, she's shown herself to be to the right of George Bush, which is a very slim place over there, I think. How can you get over there? it's got to be a pretty fall off the edge.
Is that trend line, and I think, as you say, the trend line suddenly dips even more, and it has not been going up in any way, shape, or form. Well, Peter, this is great. Thanks so much for your perspective. We'll talk again before this election hits us in the face, just to carry on and keep up. Well, how would you recommend that people become more informed about you and or the things you care about?
You bet. Yeah, thanks. I think the best thing you can do is, Google just Alaska and wilderness, and you can find some groups there that do really, really good work to support the wild places that are in Alaska. You know, I've worked with a lot, as I've mentioned, national conservation groups and Alaska conservation groups that have been standing, drawing the line in the sand in very, very difficult circumstances when we had the strong Republican Congress and held off drilling in the Arctic Refuge, an unbelievable epic battle that ultimately was won, and we need to keep vigilant on. So those kind of things are really important. I think doing what you can to help protect our natural legacy in the United States, and Sydney, through efforts like yours, it's just a great thing to be doing, keeping people educated on it. So thanks for the opportunity to come on and talk with you.
Thank you, and we'll do this again. Peter Van Tine, thanks so much.
Bye-bye, Sydney.
Bye.
Come, senators, congressmen, please heed the call. Don't stand in the doorway, don't lock up the hall. For he that gets hurt will be he who has stalled. The battle outside raging will soon shake your windows and rattle your walls. For the times, they are a-changing.
McCain isn't making great decisions these days. His choice of Sarah Palin, who is now regularly upstaging him on the campaign stump, speaks volumes to the specter of the price we may pay for his decision-making. Seems everything's the judgment call these days. In this case, you are the ultimate judge.
Your old road is a wrap. rapidly aging. Please get out of the new one if you can't lend your hand, for the times they are a-changing.
This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios until we meet next Tuesday or any time on the archives when your voice of the earth rings out around the world here on the Wildside News.